Welcome to the First Century Church Podcast. My name is Stephen Wilhoy, and I'm the lead pastor at First Century Church, and it is an honor to have you with us today. The goal of the podcast is simple. We want you to be encouraged, challenged, and inspired to go further in your faith than ever before. If you'd like more information about the church, you can visit our website, firstcenturykc.com. And if you happen to be in the Kansas City area anytime soon, we'd love to have you join us for one of our live gatherings to connect with you in person. Again, thanks for joining us today, and we hope that you enjoy today's message. So we're going to continue our series, Complex. This is week 14 in the book of Job. And so if you thought it was depressing, we've been in this for 14 weeks. And so it's just, you know, maybe even worse than you ever imagined it would be. But hopefully, again, this series has been helpful for you as it's just real life type of stuff. It's, you know, the Bible is very practical. It's not just this pie in the sky sort of stuff that doesn't apply. It is just very much in our everyday life. And so we've been going through this book. We're going to make a bit of a shift today, and I'll explain why at the beginning, and then another explanation will come later. We're going to skip ahead because so far what we've seen in this book is we've seen Job's situation, how it's unfolded, and then we've heard from all three of his friends who are present, who came to see him, and we've heard his response to all three of them. We're going to skip ahead to Job 32 and a few chapters following because I want us to hear from a fourth friend that is not listed at the beginning of this book. He just sort of pops out of nowhere, but as we see, he's been here the entire time. He's been listening to everything that's been said. He's really been chomping at the bit to get his turn to speak, as we'll see today. And so we're going to look at this fourth sort of surprise friend whose name is Elihu. He shows up in Job 32. And so you can go ahead and flip there if you want, or use the YouVersion Bible app for your notes if you want to follow along today. So what I want us to do first is get introduced to this fourth friend, sort of meet him, learn a bit of backstory, details about him, and then we'll look at a couple of major themes that he shares from his point of view as he's been listening to all this discussion that's been going on. So join me in Job 32. We're going to look at verses 2 through 5 to get introduced to this character, Elihu. Job 32, verse 2. Then Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. He burned with anger also at Job's three friends because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, he burned with anger. A lot of context clues here. Let's kind of fill in who this person Elihu is by the description that we have of him, and then we'll get into his message. So we see first he's young. So as we looked at last week, Zophar, the third friend of the three listed, seemed to have been the youngest. So tradition in the Near East in that ancient time, the oldest would speak, and then the next oldest, then the youngest. And so they've gone in that order. And Elihu, even though he's not even listed at the beginning of this book, waits his turn. He is the youngest. And we'll see that here as we continue looking at him in just a second. So this is why he's speaking last here to the friends. We also see, you probably noticed the word that came up a few times, he's very angry. Four times in these four verses we read he is full of anger. We'll look at that more in a second as well. What's also unique about Elihu from the other three friends is that we get a bit of a family history of Elihu. The other guys, we learn kind of the land or the part of the country or part of the region where they come from. But with him, we get he's the son of Barachel, the Buzite, the family of Ram. We have like a whole genealogy, like a mini genealogy for this guy. So here's a connection here's where a lot of scholars think he could be coming from. So Buz or Buz, the Buzite, Buz was the name of a nephew of Abraham listed in Genesis 22. So it seems it's not out of the realm of possibility that Elihu is maybe the great or great-great-grandnephew of Abraham. So there, he could be in that family tree. Other scholars see, it says the family of Ram, they see Ram as a colloquial reference to or a nickname for Abraham himself. So either way you really look at this history, there is a familial connection from Elihu to Abraham. And so that's very interesting to see here. And his name also sort of points to some more of these ideas too. The name Elihu means he is my God. He is my God. If you think about how that word looks and sounds, the name Elihu is similar to Elijah. And Elijah means Yahweh is my God. So because of these different types of connections, a lot of scholars sort of see Elihu just jumping in here out of nowhere, almost as a prophetic voice. He's sort of there behind the scenes, and he just sort of pounces at the right moment. He's been waiting to deliver this message that he feels is from God, as we'll see in a moment. And then all of a sudden, he just lets people have it. He just lets them know what's on his mind. He speaks the words that seem to be from God. Now, it's kind of complicated. His words, we won't read a lot of his speech because God's going to say a lot of the same things that he's saying, which is very interesting, and I think a good thing for Elihu here. So a lot of his words sound like God, and then when God does speak, he does rebuke all three of Job's other friends for speaking falsely against him, but he does not address Elihu's words, which gives you, you know, some evidence here that what he's saying is probably fairly good for the most part. And it sort of explains his angry anger here. If he's like an Old Testament prophet, if you've read the Old Testament prophets, they seem kind of angry a lot of the time. They're describing destruction and sin and all these types of things. And so he fits with that as well. He sort of sits back, gets his word, and declares it sort of in this righteous anger, if you will. Now, as we've sort of seen already and we'll continue to see today, Elihu declares one thing to Job's friends and one thing to Job. So Elihu declares that the other friends were wrong about God. So he is sort of summing up what we've been talking about for several weeks now. Job's three friends, they have this oversimplistic worldview based on their personal opinions, their experience, their own pride, and it's just not right. And God will say the same thing to them later on. And then Elihu does have a message for Job. He says, Job, you've also been wrong toward God. Because the other three friends, the reason they're wrong about God is they have claimed, well, Job is being punished by God. God only punishes wicked sinners. So, Job, you're declaring that you're righteous, but the evidence here that we're seeing from our worldview is that you must have some secret sin or some unconfessed thing that you've been wicked about. And he's saying they're wrong, but for Job, he thinks that Job, in his speech, has taken things a little too far in approaching God. Now, he thinks he's sort of crossed a line. There is some debate on this point because, again, God doesn't really say anything about what Elihu says, but some of what Elihu says, while it sounds like what God will say later, also sort of in some ways sounds like some of what his friends have already said. He's kind of a jumbled mess here. You can tell he's like this young, angry guy who just really wants to get it all out, and it's like, slow down. Get your thoughts together and then come back to me later. But he just lets it all out here. Now, after God speaks, Job does sort of walk back a little bit of his attitude. There is some repentance there that we'll see later on. But also, some of God's final words declare that Job had, quote, spoken of me what is right. So is Elihu confused here? Maybe. Is he just overeager? Maybe. Is he too harsh on Job? Maybe, but God doesn't comment on it, so we don't know for sure. We just sort of have to gauge from the context of what he's saying and the message of what he's saying to sort of figure out what's good and what's bad. And we also have to remember that none of the five men in this dialogue, in this story, in this book of Job, none of them are completely perfect. They're all humans just like us. So they're not sinless. They're not exactly right. They don't know everything there is to know. They're just trying like we are to figure out God, which is an okay thing to try, but an impossible thing to actually do, isn't it? And that's where they're at. They're where we are as well. So I think a good explanation of who Elihu is he is the most right of Job's friends, and I would say the most helpful of Job's friends. So it's good that we've seen weeks and weeks and weeks of terrible advice, ripping him apart, saying false things about him, Job on his heels, defending himself. Now, with the fourth friend that pops up all of a sudden, we get to see a little bit better treatment of the situation. So we've met Elihu now. Let's look at two main themes. This is how I'm going to break it down today, as two gifts. Elihu is going to describe, and he goes on for about six chapters uninterrupted. He has the longest speech of anyone in the entire book. And so he doesn't go back and forth. He says his whole thing at once. Job doesn't really have much of a response. And then God comes in after that and gives his final address at the end of this book. So it's a lot here all at once. But there's really two main themes, two main gifts that first Elihu believes he's received from God and is hopefully trying to use in communicating. And in communicating that, he's trying to help Job to receive these two gifts from God as well. And I think that as we look at them today, they will be helpful gifts for us as well. And so let's look at these two gifts that Elihu describes here in these chapters in Job. Gift number one that Elihu describes is the gift of patience. Anybody that you know needs a gift of patience, not you, but somebody that you know needs the gift of patience, right? That's typically how we, you know, view this one. We could all use more of this gift, absolutely. We could all exercise this gift, absolutely. So let's look at how Elihu describes this gift of patience and really where it comes from. So Job 32 is where we're going to be at the beginning here. Job 32, look at verses 11 and 12 first as he's sort of getting into his speech properly here. He says, "Behold, I waited for your words. I listened to your wise sayings while you searched out what to say. I gave you my attention, and behold, there was none among you who refuted Job or who answered his words." Then skip down to verse 18, Job 32, 18. And then he says this, "For I am full of words, and the spirit within me constrains me. Behold, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. I must speak that I might find relief. I must open my lips and answer." So Elihu has been sitting by, apparently, this entire time, just listening and growing more and more frustrated, more and more angry. I can just imagine this young guy here already chomping at the bit to give his view, his opinion, his speech. I can just imagine him from time to time really just wanting to interrupt, like, ah! But then he holds back. Well, what? I'll just wait. Well, what? And he just wait, he's showing restraint. He's showing this gift that he believes he's been given in this moment of patience. The description that he gives, I have an image here to show you, is of a wineskin. So it's this ancient form of holding wine, this container. It's made of animal hides. And so when they're new, he talks about a new wineskin. So when a wineskin is new, it is more stretchy. It will give more. And so when you put new wine in the wineskin, it still may ferment a little bit. And so it's going to release gas and pressure, and it's going to cause this wineskin to expand. Now, so Jesus talks about this in the Gospels as well. He says you can't put new wine into old wineskins. The reason is because an old wineskin is worn out. It's tougher. It won't stretch. And so if the new wine goes in and it tries to expand and the gases go and there's pressure, it will burst and everything will be ruined. But he's saying, I'm like a new wineskin about to burst. This is how much pressure he is feeling about. He is like bubbling inside. He has got to get this out. He just can't sit by silently any longer. He's got to share this message with him. That's how much this is for him. And he says that this is coming from, in verse 19, he said this is coming from his belly. So the ancients in this culture would have typically believed that the human spirit or the emotion resided in the abdomen, in the belly, in your gut, so to speak. But he's showing restraint and patience. He's not going with his gut on his advice here. He said the spirit, in verse 18, the spirit is restraining me. Now, the context there seems to indicate he's not talking about his spirit. The belly is him. He says everything inside of me humanly wants to just explode on you guys and interrupt and just say everything I'm thinking. But the spirit of God is giving me this gift of patience. I'm not going to fly off the handle. I'm not going to do these outbursts. So he's showing and using this gift of patience. So just for a few minutes, I want us to look at really three practical things that patience does for us. This gift of patience, I think Elihu shows these three things confidently here. And so we'll look at these three benefits that patience will do for us as we hopefully receive and exercise it in our own lives. Here's the first practical thing that patience does for us. Patience shows wisdom, maturity, and spiritual growth. Patience shows wisdom, maturity, and spiritual growth. Let's look at a couple of scriptures here really quickly to illustrate this idea. Two from the Proverbs, other wisdom literature from the Old Testament. Proverbs 14:29, it says this, "People with understanding control their anger. A hot temper shows great foolishness." Proverbs 19, verse 2, "Enthusiasm without knowledge is no good. Haste makes mistakes." That'd be a great bumper sticker, by the way. Haste makes mistakes. It'd be a good thing to put, like, you know, on your refrigerator and on your mirror. Like, you can just see that all the time. Haste makes mistakes. So Elihu's patience and restraint here is showing wisdom beyond his years. He is by far the youngest in the group here. He's waited till the very last to get his little speech out here, and he's showing great wisdom in waiting to say what he says and in what he says. There is some anger, there is some emotion, but it does seem at least a bit controlled. It does seem at least a little bit thought through here. I love that line in that proverb, enthusiasm without knowledge is no good. That was the mistake that Zophar made that we looked at last week. Who we thought was the youngest friend, that described him perfectly. Enthusiasm without knowledge, and it was no good. And I love that. Haste makes mistakes. You ever notice that? It's like the one day this week that you're in a rush to get to work and you're driving like a maniac. That's the day you rear end somebody. You were already late, already stressed out. Haste makes mistakes. And you're trying to weave in and out and you don't see the taillights in front of you and then you crash into them. Or if you're baking something and you're like, oh, we got to go. I got to get this in the oven to get to their house for whatever is coming up. And you accidentally put, you know, salt instead of sugar in your dessert. Haste makes mistakes. Elihu is giving us some really good wisdom here as he's showing us the value of patience. Patience shows spiritual growth and maturity. It's listed in Galatians 5 as a fruit of the Spirit. So not only is it a gift that God gives us, but it then becomes a mile marker for the progression in our faith. It's one of those major ways we can see how my faith is growing, how I'm growing in my faith. Patience is one of those markers. And I think Elihu's approach here is exactly what James says in the New Testament. So let's look at James 1:19 and look at what he says about this idea. He says, understand this, my dear brothers and sisters. You must all be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to get angry. So while Elihu admits that he's angry, while the first four verses that we get introduced to him say, this guy is a young, angry buck here, okay? He is just full of emotion. He says, hey, I waited to speak. I listened to what you said, and now I'm going to say my piece. And so he's following James's progression here, which I think is another sign of wisdom beyond his years. And the Apostle Paul, you see it there, Colossians 3:12, he describes the gift of patience as a garment. Look at this, Colossians 3:12. He says, since God chose you to be the holy people he loves, you must clothe yourselves with tenderhearted mercy, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. So Paul is saying something similar to what I think Elihu was getting at. You've got to use the gift that you're given. You've got to put it on, wear it, take it with you everywhere you go. Think of it as a piece of clothing. And so what we don't want to do, we don't want to be surprised when we finally show patience, like, whoa, can you believe how patient I was? Like, pat me on the back. It's like, okay, that's great. Rather, what is better is when you don't show patience, you feel naked and exposed. Like, wait a second, I didn't handle that right at all. I was too rough with them. I didn't wait like I should have. I rushed the process, and so I got to go fix this. That's what I think they're pointing at here, is that we should see this. And this develops over time. We grow in this gift over time. So the second thing that patience does for us in this list of three things that we see here is patience proves our trustworthiness. Patience proves our trustworthiness. Look later on in Job 32 what Elihu says about his patience here. He says in verse 21 and 22, I will not show partiality to any man or use flattery toward any person, for I do not know how to flatter, else my maker would soon take me away. So Elihu is saying, I'm going to use my words very carefully, and I'm going to try to speak fairly. And he thinks, I think correctly, that the other three friends have not done this. They have not shown patience. They've not listened. They've not waited. They've not been aware. And they've just said whatever, and it's not been helpful. It's not been fair. So the truth is that if you and I want to be taken seriously in life, we have to exercise patience. The mistake that happens is if we just spout off all the time, you know what's going to happen? You're going to get a lot more eye rolls behind your back than you realize, because you get that reputation. What happens is if you're prone to angry outbursts, you'll be seen as just an emotional mess, not someone people can trust. If all your advice is shallow from the hip and doesn't work, you show yourself to be unreliable. If our life strategy is to kind of lick our finger and hold it up in the air, you know, what's going to happen is you're going to walk in circles aimlessly, and you're going to lead people that are counting on you in circles aimlessly as well. Patience is required for us to be seen as trustworthy. If we're constantly led by our impulses and emotions, we're going to run into brick wall after brick wall, and eventually we're going to flame out. So we have to grow in patience. And as we do that, in word and deed, we build trust. Because the opposite of all those things is also true. If people know that you take time to think before you speak, it builds credibility of you to them. as you take time to think things through, you show consistency in your actions, in your words, in your behavior, and that's a good thing. As we're thoughtful with others' decisions and questions, you show them that you really care about them. They're not just a problem to solve like Job is to his friends. It's not just a, hey, I can fix you real quick and move on to the next project. I mean, friend in my life. But when you really take the time to sit with someone, listen to them, talk through some stuff, pray through some stuff, and come to a reasonable conclusion or decision or next step or just solid advice, you prove yourself, we prove ourselves to be trustworthy. I think this is one of the reasons that the youngest in the group goes for 6 chapters uninterrupted. He is proving that he's earned their respect by his patience, this gift that God's given him. And then, as a result, here's the third thing that this gift of patience does. Patience then strengthens relationships. It strengthens relationships. So Elihu does come out hot, but his words seem at least somewhat measured and reasoned, and he does seem to really want to help. The other friends clearly are coming at him in a different type of way. They want to beat him down. They want to rub his nose in what they think is his sin. They want to find any little flaw in his character. And he really seems to be coming at a different sort of angle, at a different sort of place. So here's a benefit to a couple more scriptures, then we'll move on to the second gift. Here's a benefit of patience in relationships. Proverbs 15, verse 18 tells us this. A hot-tempered person starts fights. A cool-tempered person stops them. So what patience does is it lowers the temperature in the room. When things are getting really tense, it's the patient person that can save that situation. If you got 2 hotheads, it's going to be just a complete disaster. But if one of the people can at least cool down, calm down for a moment, it can really prevent unnecessary pain and hurt in that relationship. And really, as followers of Jesus, we'll look at Ephesians 4, as followers of Jesus, patience is expected. It's part of our faith. It's part of what following Jesus looks like. And Paul shows us a huge relational benefit to it. So look with me at Ephesians 4, verses 1 through 3. Paul says, "Therefore I, a prisoner for serving the Lord, beg you to lead a life worthy of your calling, for you have been called by God. Always be humble and gentle. Be patient with each other, making allowances for each other's faults because of your love." Catch this, verse 3. "Make every effort to keep yourselves united in the Spirit, binding yourselves together with peace." So Paul says that patience is an extension of love, which is the major marker of a follower of Jesus, especially with one another. So patience makes me have room for others' humanness, which is so important relationally. Patience brings about, Paul says, unity that produces peace. All it starts with is just stopping for a second, waiting an extra tick before we say or do something. That creates unity that brings about peace, because that type of behavior is contagious. That type of behavior has amazing positive ripple effects that can affect not just you, but then it goes out from you to everybody else around you. Patience really is the gift that keeps on giving. That's why it's such an important gift. And so may we receive it and then use it in our lives. That's the first gift that Elihu tells us here in the book of Job. The second gift that Elihu gets to here is the gift of understanding. The gift of understanding. Go back to Job chapter 32, back up near the top at verse 6. And here is when he really actually gets started. He starts out with this. And so here's how his speech begins. It says, "And Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, answered and said, 'I am young in years and you are aged. Therefore, I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion to you. I said, let days speak and many years teach wisdom. But,' he says, 'it is the spirit in man, the breath of the Almighty, that makes him understand. It is not the old who are wise, nor the aged who understand what is right. Therefore, I say, listen to me, let me also declare my opinion.'" This is sort of the, I would call it maybe a pseudo-apology at the beginning of, he's sort of like, okay, guys, let me give you a warning. What I'm about to tell you is going to be tough to hear, but I feel like it's from God. That's kind of what he's doing here in this moment. He's like, "I heard you old guys out, and you guys are just full of hot air. You said nothing that was good, nothing that was helpful, nothing that was hard true at all, especially about Job. And so I'm going to kind of have to set you guys straight. Yes, the young guy, the guy you think knows nothing. I'm telling you, the understanding I have doesn't come from me. It comes from the breath of the Almighty is what he tells them. Now, that is also a big claim. If you're telling somebody, hey, I have a word from the Lord for you, you better be right. You better have heard from God. You better not just flippantly, drop the God card on people and guilt them into what you want them to do. And I don't think he's doing that here, but I'm saying we got to be very careful if we use that kind of language and mentality here because, I can't make God look bad because I'm speaking for him when he didn't speak. It's kind of the idea of Elihu here. And also, it is sort of a personal dig at the friends. He's getting a little, he's dunking on them just a little bit. He's saying, hey, you guys think you know everything, and you guys know nothing. Boom, dunk, let's move on. That's sort of what he does here. And really what he's declaring about understanding is he's making sure they know true understanding comes from God. That's the theme. Now, a couple questions here is, how does God give this understanding? How does he communicate, basically, is the question. How do I know if I'm hearing from God? How do I know if this understanding is coming from him or from some other source? And so in Job 33, skip forward a little bit to Job 33, he tells us, he lists several ways that God can speak and give us understanding. Job 33, start at verse number 12. He says, behold, in this you are not right. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Why do you contend against him, saying he will answer none of man's words? For God speaks in one way and in two, though man does not perceive it. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on men while they slumber on their beds, then he opens the ears of men and terrifies them with warnings, that he may turn man aside from his deed and conceal pride from a man. He keeps back his soul from the pit, his life from perishing by the sword. And then skip to verses 29 and 30, Job 33, 29 and 30. Behold, God does all these things twice, three times with a man to bring back his soul from the pit, that he may be lighted with the light of life. So Elihu is saying here, God is always speaking to us. Always. The question is not, is God speaking? The question is, am I tuned to his frequency? Am I listening for his voice? Am I watching for a little sign here, a little glimmer there, a word, a thought, a dream, he even says? Am I listening and waiting, anticipating for God to speak? Is that what we're doing here? And so just for fun, just for a few minutes, it's fun for me. We'll see if it's fun for you. It may not be. But just for fun, what I want to do is we've got a list here. I want to just give you a list of a few of the unique ways that God had chosen to speak to people in Scripture. Just to kind of give you an idea of God can use any method he wants. He can speak at any time he wants. He can use anything he wants to get us to understand what he's trying to do. So let's look at just a few of these really quickly, just kind of for fun, okay? So dreams is one that Elihu lists, obviously, and that happens all throughout the Bible. One interesting point, because there's a connection possibly from Elihu to Abraham. So in Genesis 20, a very, maybe probably not well-known story about Abraham. So Abraham and Sarah are in Egypt at this time, and it seems, it's still not clear why they do this, but they claim to be brother and sister. And it's basically because I think Abraham thinks, okay, if I tell the Egyptians, hey, this hottie's my wife, they're probably going to arrest me to just take her. And so if I say I'm her brother, then they'll be like, hey, bro, your sister's hot, you know? And so it won't be as big of a deal. It's kind of what this seems like what he's saying, okay? And so this man named Ahimelech, sees the beauty of Sarah and is going to take her for the night. Now he doesn't. And while he's there in the room with her, he has a dream. And God says, hey, do not touch her. Leave her alone. Abraham is not her brother. That's her husband. Hands off. And so then he comes back to Abraham and says, dude, what gives? Like, you could have just maybe said, you could have told me. Like, God was going to kill me in my sleep if I slept with your wife, and it would have been your fault. What's the deal? It's such a weird story, but I love the connection there because, Elihu maybe has heard this story from his family. This one time, your crazy great-great uncle did this weird thing in Egypt, and it's like a really neat campfire kind of story, and so that's why I like that in there as well. And then we have the two Josephs in Genesis. Joseph, the young man who has these dreams, it really directs his entire life, doesn't it? I mean, from a time he's a teenager to the end of his life, dreams are everything to him. And then Joseph, the earthly father of Jesus Christ, he is told in a dream not to divorce Mary once he's found out she's pregnant. And so dreams are a huge way that God has spoken to people in the past, and I think still can to this day. Then we obviously have the burning bush in Exodus 3 with Moses. He's chosen to lead God's people out of slavery through this bush that is on fire but not being consumed. And then a voice comes from it. If it wasn't weird enough, then it starts talking. He's like, whoa, what, you know, did I eat some bad meat or something? Like, what is going on? But God spoke to him in that unconventional way. Then we have Balaam's donkey in Numbers 22. It's, you know, one of the favorite kids' church stories because a donkey talks, and that's really cool. And so you have Balaam, who's this prophet who's going to pronounce judgment against Israel. God's trying to stop him. And so he puts this angel in the middle of the road as he's going along. He doesn't see the angel, does he? But the donkey he's riding sees this angel blocking their path, and he just stops walking. And so then Balaam beats the donkey, and then the donkey talks to him and says, hey, don't you see this angel in the road? He kind of like does this thing with his eyes like, oh, wow, hey, donkey, you're right. And I don't know, maybe Balaam's name should be Shrek or something, but, you know, talking donkeys and all that kind of stuff. But so God can, if he wants to, I'm not saying he will in your case, if he wants to use a farm animal to talk to you, he can do that. He can do that, all right? Then we have Gideon's fleece in Judges 6. You know, Elihu uses this rhetorical language where he says God will speak once and twice to a man, and then later on he says he'll speak twice and three times to a man. This is sort of how this fleshes out for Gideon. So Gideon is called by God to lead God's people. He's the next leader. And, you know, as you would expect, he's not really sure about that. And so he lays out this piece of fleece on the ground outside at night, and he says, okay, God, I need a sign. And so if I wake up in the morning and the fleece is wet, but the ground around it is completely dry, then I'll know that you really sent me to lead these people. And God does that. And so then Gideon, being a human, just like we are, says, okay, God, could I get one more sign? In fact, could I get the exact opposite sign tonight? Could the fleece be dry and the ground be wet this time? And then I'll really believe you. And God's like, sure, no problem. And he does that. And so then Gideon's like, okay, I give. Let's do this thing. I believe what you've said. And so once, twice, three times, God can speak as often as he wants to us as well. And then, you know, the prophets, they do some crazy things and say some crazy things. Like Ezekiel is told at one time to sleep on one, to stay on one side, like on the ground for 390 days. One day for every year that Israel has sinned against me. And then after you've kind of, you know, gotten the king side of your back there, flip to your other side for 40 more days for every year that Judah has sinned against me. So all crazy kind of things like that. Jeremiah, all the prophets do some wild things. And then the final one we have, then we'll move off of this, is, you know, Elijah's whisper in 1 Kings 19. And so at this point, Elijah has just come off a great, huge victory. He's on you would think a spiritual high. Like, whoa, God, you're great. You can do anything. I called down fire from heaven and you literally answered. And yet he's like totally depressed. Like he wants to die. He says, God, kill me. And God says, hey, instead of that, go up on the mountain and I'll meet with you there. And so, of course, you probably know the story. As Elijah goes up, he's waiting for God to appear. And as he's there, an earthquake shakes the mountain, and then a firestorm comes by, and then a windstorm comes by the opening of this mountain. But God, it says, is not in any of those. And then Elijah hears something faintly, and he realizes that the Lord is now whispering to him. And so what that shows us is that sometimes God may not speak to us in ways that we're expecting, so we have to expect him to speak to us in any way. It may take a couple times for God to get through to our thick skulls. Maybe it's just me that has that problem. Maybe you hear God the first time and you're just like, yes, let's run with that thing, God. But I'm usually not that way. And so we have to just learn that God will speak sometimes in unconventional ways or open. Again, the question is not, is God speaking? The question is, am I listening? Will I perceive what God is saying? But let's end on this. That's, in general, what God can and will do. But Elihu is saying to Job, God is speaking to you. He's giving you understanding in a very specific way. So what does Elihu say is the way that God is giving Job understanding? Go back to Job 33, verses 19 through 22. Here's what Elihu tells Job. He says, man is also rebuked with pain on his bed, and with continual strife in his bones, so that his life loathes bread and his appetite the choicest food. His flesh is so wasted away that it cannot be seen, and his bones that were not seen stick out. His soul draws near the pit, there that is again, and his life to those who bring death. Then skip a few chapters later in Job 36, verse 15, Elihu says this, he, that's God, delivers the afflicted by their affliction, and opens their ear by adversity. So now, whether fortunately or unfortunately, for the first time in this entire discussion, someone has finally given Job what will be the most accurate possible reason for his suffering. Elihu is saying, what I'm sensing is, your friends are saying your sin is causing your suffering. He's saying, here's what I'm suggesting. This is what Elihu's saying. What I'm suggesting is this, that your suffering is a method God is using to give you deeper connection to him, increased reliance upon him, and additional understanding of him. Elihu is saying, your suffering is for a purpose. Now, he doesn't necessarily claim to know what that is, because he doesn't know. Job still doesn't know what that is. Even at the end, once God shows up, he's going to answer every question. Wrong you are. Job never, as far as we know in the story, never knows the why to his suffering. But Elihu is the first person and only person to tell him, this is unfortunately for you the way that God is giving you more understanding of him. And I don't like saying that. And Stephen doesn't like saying that. Elihu doesn't like it. I don't like it. But, I mean, it checks out. C.S. Lewis wrote this in his book, The Problem of Pain. He says this, God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. So we cannot always be certain of why we experience pain, loss, suffering, or tragedy, but we can see God in those things. We can gain understanding of ourselves, of others, and of God in those things. Again, I don't like delivering this news, but I preach the Bible, and that's what it's telling us. And if you're a Christian who has or is suffering or is in pain, you probably would agree, even though you don't like it either, to what we're saying. This is the best answer given to Job about his suffering. Now, is he correct? We don't know because God never answers that question again. But I do think we can know this, that God never acts arbitrarily. He never just decides to do a random thing for no reason. And so in everything that we face, good, bad, or in between, there's always something to learn, gain, and understand. There's always a reason, there's always a purpose that God has, even if we never know the reason. So what I want to do is end by reading, it's a little bit long, I didn't want to do this, but I'm going to end. This is kind of a sort of a closing prayer of response that I want you to receive it in this way. There's a huge connection between, I think, Job and Psalm 73. So I want to read basically the last two-thirds of this psalm, verses 12 through 28, and I want you to listen to how the psalmist is writing this. You can see it kind of go almost back and forth, sort of like a conversation. You can almost see Job and his friends sort of having some of these words in their mouths, and it's not written by Job, but you can, again, almost hear him maybe even say this as a response now to Elihu. So that's how I kind of want us to receive this sort of closing scripture. Psalm 23, again, we're going to read verses 12 through 28 as we sort of wrap up and land the plane today. Here's what Psalm 73 says. Look at these wicked people enjoying a life of ease while their riches multiply. Did I keep my heart pure for nothing? Did I keep myself innocent for no reason? I get nothing but trouble all day long. Every morning brings me pain. If I had really spoken this way to others, I would have been a traitor to your people. So I tried to understand why the wicked prosper, but what a difficult task it is. Then I went into your sanctuary, O God, and I finally understood the destiny of the wicked. Truly, you put them on a slippery path and send them sliding over the cliffs to destruction. In an instant, they are destroyed, completely swept away by terrors. When you arise, O Lord, you will laugh at their silly ideas, as a person laughs at dreams in the morning. Then I realized that my heart was bitter, and I was all torn up inside. I was so foolish and ignorant. I must have seemed like a senseless animal to you. Yet I still belong to you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, leading me to a glorious destiny. Whom have I in heaven but you? I desire you more than anything on earth. My health may fail and my spirit may grow weak, but God remains the strength of my heart. He is mine forever. Those who desert him will perish, for you destroy those who abandon you. But as for me, how good it is to be near God. I have made the sovereign Lord my shelter, and I will tell everyone about the wonderful things you do. Why is Job suffering? He does not really know. And we have, unfortunately, most of the time, the same answer. Why do we suffer? We, most of the time, if ever, we just don't know. But Elihu shows us in our suffering, God gives us these two amazing gifts. He gives us patience to grow, to endure, and to overcome. And he gives us understanding to learn about him and then to lean into him. So my prayer is that we would receive and develop these gifts to become who God desires, and that we would become, that we would accomplish all that God has for us to do. Even through suffering, pain, heartache, all those things, these two gifts can make that possible. Let's pray as we close today. God, we desire these gifts in our lives of faith. And so may we grow in patience, may we put it on to aid us in decisions, to enhance our relationships, as further evidence of our maturity in you. Help us to resist the anger of the culture around us. Help us to not be led by emotion or impulse, but help us to stop and think and pray about what you might be doing in our lives. Give us that patience that we so desperately need. And God, we want to understand you more, and you're always speaking, so may we be listening. Help us to be tuned to your frequency. Now, we're not looking for suffering, but we know that you speak to us in that. And so in our suffering, we don't want to waste it by just agonizing or thinking about how bad things are. We want to see, always be looking up. God, what are you doing? What are you saying? Give me more understanding. And God, may we continue to seek you for the answers to our questions. May you continue to be the source of our hope and joy and peace. Thank you, God, for these gifts. May we receive them and then use them well. In Jesus' name, amen.